It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska's rivers are the best path to see the backcountry for non-motorized adventurers traveling in relative comfort and seeing the grandeur of the state. But cold moving water in remote areas can be dangerous. Every summer, we hear stories of tragedies and near misses on Alaska's rivers. On today's show, we're taking that topic head on. I'll be talking with two very experienced river paddlers who have a strong safety ethic. We'll talk about the wonder of floating and fishing Alaska's rivers and the excitement of white water, but we'll emphasize the safety rules and tips that can help you come back alive. Well, I've got two guests in the studio today who know tons and tons about floating rivers and doing it safely because they're still around and they're not like 20-year-olds.
You didn't have to say that, Charles.
Yeah. Well, they would figure it out pretty soon. Les Guerra is known to a lot of folks around town as a member of the Alaska legislature. He's unopposed in his run, so there's no political aspect to our show today. And his old friend, Venable Vermont, they're also both attorneys, is very experienced and has been floating Alaska rivers for more than 30 years. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for doing this, Charles.
Yeah, glad to be here.
We got the idea to do the show because it's the end of the season or nearing it, and we've heard all the stories over the course of the summer, as we always do, about tragedies and near tragedies that happen on Alaska rivers. And so we were going to start out today's show. It's not going to be the whole show, but we're going to start out talking about safety and what are the common things that happen on Alaska rivers that lead to disaster, because we all know it happens. And you guys have survived, so you must be doing something right. But it's a really serious topic. We don't want to scare people away from the rivers, but we want them to be safe. Les, do you have a sense of like what are your main concerns when you pick, you know, and sometimes you pick up the paper and read about what people have done?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, I want to do the part that is important, which is say it's an amazing way to see the state. You know, we have these river highways where there are no highways. That's the way you see so much of the state if you can, even free trips along the road system. But, you know, my biggest concern is I think people without whitewater training are tempted to do whitewater rivers. And I've had friends who have had to talk down. And, you know, the whole idea of no whitewater experience necessary is that's false. You should never do a river in a raft, in a canoe, in a kayak, in a watercraft without training. And there's real training out there for people.
Right. And there was this disaster or accident tragedy that happened on the Congacut River on a guided trip this very summer, where it sounded like that was maybe a factor.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I don't know the facts, so no blame to anybody. I want to be clear about that, but. You know, in the brochure that the guides use, and I'm pretty sure I know what they meant, there was some sort of statement along the lines of no whitewater experience necessary. And I think probably what they meant was they'll put you in their raft for the canyon. Well, there's a major canyon on that river. It was a tragedy that two people passed away. We don't know what happened. I don't know if it was anybody's fault. But it does raise the whole issue of the statement, no whitewater experience necessary. I think what they meant was, if you don't have whitewater experience, we'll put you in our raft and we'll get you through. But you can die on a river. I've done that river three times. It's a beautiful river. It's the only river where I've had my raft ever pinned against a rock and had to think about swimming to safety. And I've run into more people on that river afterwards or during the trip who have flipped than any other river. And it's got a sort of underrated class 3 rapid that most people think is easy.
Venable, we also hear about a lot of folks drowning nearer to Anchorage, maybe early in the season, or maybe just like trying to float the Eagle River or something. And because you can definitely get moving water. It's always somewhat dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
Well, that's true. But even before moving water, I would say cold water, because a number of the drowning deaths that we hear about in the spring, not long after ice out, occur in the little local lakes and ponds where people go out sunny day, as we saw this year, you know, late May or mid-May, beautiful, warm. And, oh, you just go out in your boat and you paddle out to the middle. Well, one or more have been drinking. They turn over and, you know, somebody drowns and somebody swims. And that's a cold water phenomenon mixed with our ubiquitous problem of alcohol.
Yeah.
And then when you add moving water to that, like Eagle River, which is also cold, extremely cold, glacial. It's not even as warm as these lakes. You've really got a recipe for disaster if you're not prepared, if you don't know what you're doing. So I guess the key is mindfulness.
PFD. I mean, that's step one.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to make more than any other is, you know, river safety starts with a, as you say, PFD, that's a personal flotation device or a life jacket. It's got to start there. And I wear one all the time. Every lake, no matter what weather, warm or cold, every river trip, I don't let anybody see me in a boat, you know, without a life jacket on. But that's only number one. It is number one, but it's only number one because with this cold weather or cold water, with alcohol, with white water, moving water, you can die with your life jacket on. And I think that's what happened to a couple of these ladies on this Conga Cut trip. The life jacket is not enough. It's where you start. And then the second idea is be ready to self-rescue. You've got to be able to take care of yourself.
And I want to get into all that, but I think that still back on the life jackets, I don't know how many times I've heard, well, a life jacket will just help them find your body because Alaska water is so cold, you'll die instantly the moment you touch it or something, which is, you kind of don't hear so much anymore, but you did used to hear that the water's so cold that, you know, well, you don't need a life jacket, which is ridiculous because...
Ridiculous.
The big hazard is you fall in and you have shock and you stop swimming, you sink, or you breathe in water. And if you have a life jacket to keep you floating for those first 20 seconds, then the chances are you've got a good 30 minutes to get out of the water. And I, you know, some of us swim in the cold water and you definitely don't die.
Yeah, you don't die, but you also know what you're doing. That's one of the disadvantages up here in Alaska. It's hard to find a place where you can practice safely in moving water in the summer. I grew up in South Carolina and our rivers were the Chattooga and some of the local, you know, mountain rivers down there. But when we paddled in May and June, we could run rapids over and over and over, practice turning over, practice getting that big gulp of air before you go in, to where you make that a natural reaction to turning over. And you don't do that up here. You don't get to practice like that up here, practice rolling your kayak under safe and repeatable conditions. So that is a problem, and it ties back into this idea that Les has of guiding people toward some kind of training.
Training is critical.
A class or a supervisor or something.
I don't know, do they include a swim in training? Because I think that once you've been in cold water, maybe some of the terror goes away because you realize, well, okay, it's not the end of the world to be in the water. You want to get out for sure. Nobody's going to linger. But you don't have to think, well, it's instant death. Les, I mean, have you done any of that?
You know, I have not done a swim yet, knock on wood. It's a smart thing to do. And in the advanced courses, they do have you swim so you can practice rescue. There is a course in Anchorage, and I know this doesn't help folks who are not in Anchorage, put on by a group called the Knik Canoers and Kayakers. And they do it for, they teach whitewater rafting, kayaking, canoeing, and I think pack rafting now too, possibly. And they give you the basics. I mean, the real basics on rescue. If you fall in the river, believe it or not, you can't just pull somebody out of the river. There's a way to get somebody out of the river. It's grabbing their life vest and falling backwards. Then they come in the boat. You can't just lift somebody out of the river.
Yeah, they're too heavy.
Too heavy with the water and everything. And there are things that you learn that are counterintuitive. And that's a great course. That's how I learned, other than, you know, going with Venable, accidentally running into this group of people who did water sports. I was lucky, but, with Venable, sort of lucky, but, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a great program for next spring, obviously. There's also some folks who are doing commercial pack raft training and other kinds of raft training, and we'll get those websites up on our website. So go to outdoorexplorer.org. Click on today's show and scroll down and you'll find those links and you can contact people to get the kind of training you need to do this stuff. So let's talk about how you guys got started. Venable, you talked for a minute about being a young person in North Carolina. That sounds like a good spot to learn. Les, how did you get into rafting?
I'm sort of fishing obsessed, and when I drove up here with my wife in 1988, I saw all these mountains, and I said, "What am I going to do in the mountains?" I grew up in New York, and New York, you always have to do something. You can't just be in the mountains. And at first, I decided I was going to fish, and then decided I was going to raft and do some canoeing too. But it was originally a way for me to get to fishing spots. You know, I'll go through serious whitewater, but I don't get the adrenaline thrill of going through the whitewater. I want to get to the next fishing spot. I want to do the raft trip.
Les,
I want to do the wilderness
trip. You're terrified in whitewater. I've been with you. There's no adrenaline thrill.
Oh, that hurts. That hurts. Venable is good at grabbing the oars from anybody whenever we get near whitewater. But
still alive, aren't you?
I'm still alive. You know, probably dead about 15 or so whitewater river trips over the years, but uh-huh. For me it really was fishing motivated, hiking motivated. There are places you can get to that, you know, on a raft or in a canoe that if you know your whitewater skills, you can get to these great places, beautiful places,
and just seeing the countryside. Yeah, yeah. Even if you're not into fishing, Venable, is whitewater something that turns you on and makes you want to go out, or
It is less so now that I'm older. I mean, I'm not into as much the adrenaline rush as I am just the scenery and the mode of travel. I like rivers, and you can have many different reasons to go on a river. The whitewater thrill, those are usually day trips, but they can be longer trips, like, say, the Grand Canyon. But as Les says, hiking, hunting, fishing, all those kind of things. My dad was a fisherman. I got my start on a river when I was 10 years old. Now, that's 55 years ago. It's hard to believe. And we weren't using canoes. We were using these old aluminum John boats, you know, square-sterned.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But fairly easy, but still a mountain whitewater river that's now drowned under a nuclear power lake. But we used to go every year on one or more trips, and we moved up to canoes, you know, as I got a little bit older. Been doing it ever since, and that's why I came to Alaska. I was doing a lot of paddling when I was in South Carolina, and I came up here for a visit and saw how much there was to do up here in the way of fishing and whitewater, and been here ever since.
It sounds like you guys have done some stuff together.
We have, yeah. I think our first trip was probably 1990 or 91, something like that. They've been primarily based around fishing because Les is obsessed, and I've done a lot of fishing in my time too, and my dad went with us on some, my brother, other people. So we've done a number of trips, and you know, on my own with my family, I've done hundreds of whitewater trips. So.
Did you learn some stuff from Venable?
Venable grabs the oars whenever you get near whitewater,
readily gives them up whenever you get near whitewater.
In his defense, so if I'm doing a whitewater trip on my own and there's a particularly bad rapid I know is coming up, and I've got to be responsible for a bunch of people, I do lose a little sleep sometimes. So if it's a really gnarly rapid, because I'm often only in that group the person who knows the whitewater stuff. There's a particular rapid. There are a number of good books that tell you what the rapids are like on the various uh-huh. rivers around the state. But sometimes a rapid develops even after they wrote the book. In Lake Creek, there's a class 4 rapid that developed after they had written the books. And I remember the first time being surprised by it because I had done it a couple years ago when the rapid didn't exist. And that rapid, like the next time, gave me a couple nightmares the night before because you can't walk along it and scout it and figure out your route. You should do that if you can. And most rapids let you do that. But I got to say, I don't really do it for the adrenaline. I do it for the experience of getting out into the wilderness, and I can handle the whitewater, but I do it for other stuff.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking today about whitewater safety and about floating Alaska's rivers in general. Try not to get too obsessed on danger and hazard and things that can go wrong, but it was one of the things that motivated us to get my two guests in today. Les Guerra, who is also a member of the State House of Representatives, but though he is unopposed in this year's election, and is an avid river floater and fisherman, as you've heard, in Venable, Vermont, retired from the law, who has been floating all his life. And my name is Charles Wolforth. You can go to our website at outdoorexplorer.org and find links for learning more about how to safely float Alaska's rivers. We realize we can't teach you everything in an hour on the radio, but hopefully inspire people to want to go out there and also want to do it safely and wear their life jackets and everything else we've been talking about. So before we totally move away from the safety issue, the limited amount of river floating I've done in canoes and so forth, I haven't done any in rafts, you really have to think about where the water is going to take you and what is in that path, right? So if there's a log or a sweeper or something like that, knowing to go around that. And that's true even if you're not in whitewater. That's true anytime you're in a river. And so part of that is kind of getting a sense of where the river naturally wants to go, right, Venable?
I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's where you start, is where's the river going to take me? And then how do I want to move around that if it's a problem? And then after that is, do I have the skills to move around it? It's not just seeing where you want to go to avoid the problem, but it's having the skills to set the canoe or to set the raft and back ferry away or whatever it is you got to do. Lean the boat the right way. I don't mean to get into the details of river safety.
Go right ahead.
But you need to know the basics of controlling your craft in increasingly difficult circumstances to control.
And one thing that's, I think, a little bit of a revelation for a canoeist anyway, is if you're used to lake canoeing, that when you're in a river and you start paddling backwards, you can actually kind of stop the boat and you have a huge amount of control going side to side through the river.
That's a real passive way to do it. It's the old way to do it, Charles. Mm-hmm. It's not really the modern way.
All right.
When you back ferry, stop the boat. It's probably better to eddy out if you can, turn, spin, face upstream, and then scout over your shoulder or even get out. Mm-hmm. When I talk about having the skills to avoid the problems, I'm talking about more from the background is a racing perspective, is overpowering. And in the long run, you can't overpower the river. But in order to control your craft, you need to go faster than the water, not slower. So the back ferrying method is old, and they used to do that. And what you would do was essentially back into an eddy or back into slower water while you're studying the river downstream. But if you're going to have to make a move or bust a move, as we say, you need more power, more speed. You need to lean the right way. You need the strokes at the right time and in the right position, that sort of thing. So that's
I guess we're talking about different situations too, though, because I'm
different situations, but different eras.
Thinking like a family kind of flow. We're not going to go to whitewater, but we see a tree is coming down. We can really kind of deal with that pretty.
Right. And that's you're not going to take your small child out with you in a big whitewater situation, but Upper Eagle River gets plenty of people on there and can get in trouble on Upper Eagle River.
Yeah.
There's lots of sweepers. And you need to know how to back to the inside of those curves, or as I would like to do, go forward and power away from the log. You need a skill set. And as the water speed increases, as the water temperature decreases, and as the hazards increase, your skill set needs to improve as well.
Right. Les, have you ever been, I think you mentioned maybe that you had, stuck against a log, and what do you do in that situation?
Well, so Venable was talking about canoeing powering through. Rafting is sort of the opposite. You raft backwards upstream against the current. I've been fortunate. I've done a lot of white water, probably no higher than high class 4 water. I don't think I've done a class 5 rapid. But, only one time had we ever gotten stuck. And it was on the river where the women tragically died this year on the Conga Cut. And there was just a series of rocks, and there was no way to get through all of them. And in a raft, what you want to do, if you're going to hit a rock, you want to bounce the nose off the rock, so you spin. But we bounced right in the middle of the raft, and we got stuck. And so the water will, if you're stuck broadside, it'll push the raft up against the rock and possibly up so that the raft flips. And
what's going on there? Let me interrupt you a minute, Les. What's going on there is the upstream tube of the raft has water piling against it, which then dives down under it, and it imparts a torque to the raft. And so it's that upstream tube that's going to go down in the water and flip the boat toward the upstream. In other words, away from the rock that you're otherwise pinned on.
Got you.
So that, ironically, you really want to go, if you're in the raft, you want to jump toward the rock, the downstream tube, to keep the upstream side as light as possible and away from the water. Huh. Sorry, Les, I didn't mean
Yeah, I mean, obviously this isn't a lesson, but it's a lesson, and a lot of the things you need to know are counterintuitive. If you get pinned against a rock and the water's pushing you into this rock that's downstream of you, your initial instinct is to get away from the rock. And what you would do in that circumstance is you would probably flip the raft. And so the move in rafting is to do what's called high siding. You all get on the side of the raft that's up against the rock to try and get that pushed back into the water. And then the way we got unstuck is we just, two of us, it was just on the margins of water that was going to flip us. It wasn't going to flip us, and we were able to just run into the, I mean, push the raft as hard as we could to get it off that rock.
Just muscle it off.
It was you know.
Yeah, and if you're pinned, if it's right at the middle of the raft, and the same is true of canoes, it can be hard to do it, but you got to take a minute, you know, catch your breath after you're pinned and safely up on the rock or high-sided. And then figure out which way you want to spin off the rock, you know, the bow or the stern, which way, if you're in a raft, putting an oar in the current can help you pull one way or the other. You need to reassess as soon as you're stable, but that's the main thing, is getting high-sided and getting stable if you're pinned, and then figure out what you need to do.
Right, right.
Because the force of water on a canoe or filling a raft especially is tons.
Break a canoe in half in no time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bend them around if they're aluminum or snap them in half if they're plastic, yeah.
So every summer we also hear about somebody who has an unwanted adventure because they flip their raft or not too many people use canoes, but they flip their raft and they lose all their gear. And then they're maybe separated and they're cold and they don't have their stuff and they're not going to be picked up for a week or whatever. And then let the news article begin when they tell their story when they get home. Hopefully they get home. What do you guys do to prepare for the kind of a situation like that where you know everything's gone in the water and you've got to keep your crew safe? Do you want to take that first?
Sure. I've never lost anything. Luckily, we've not flipped, but, you know, Venable will say it. The first thing you do in the morning when you're getting ready, if you're on a multi-day trip or if you're on a one-day trip, the first thing you do, if you've got a lot of gear, is you cinch it down so that even if the raft flipped, you don't lose anything.
Especially in Alaska where the rescue is not immediate, the road is not there, you rig for a flip even if it's a class 2 river.
Yeah, it's sort of a pain, but yeah, you sit there every morning, you spend 20 minutes rigging the net that holds your stuff down or whatever the watercraft is and whatever your harness device is. You spend 20 minutes rigging it just in case you flip, even though you know you never have flipped. It's one day you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two kinds of people out there on whitewater, and those who have flipped and those who haven't but will,
right.
You know? It's inevitable if you're out there long enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can only reiterate what he says. You rig for the flip. You get ready. You roll up your bags, especially the one with your safety gear, your sleeping bag, that kind of stuff. Everything goes in waterproof bags. Strap down well, maybe a day bag on top. Some people that I know wear a little... like a fanny pack, a small thing on them with fire starting and a snack and a signaling device or something like that in case they get separated from their raft. That seems a little extreme, but, you know, I could certainly countenance that under the right circumstances.
Well, I think there's an aspect of sort of contingency planning in Alaska outdoors in the wilderness. You got to think about, well, what are things that could go wrong? If that went wrong, what would be the next thing that went wrong? Well, what would I do to prevent that? And so... You know, I think I, like probably most people, carry on my boat, even though it very rarely happens, maybe once in 15 years where you get stuck somewhere, that you have a way to make warm drinks and you have a way to people can change into warm clothes and you have sort of the stuff that you, if you were stuck, you'd be okay. And it sounds like you guys, of course, would do that as well.
Well, I think if you don't lose your boat and you don't lose your gear, then based on the fact that you're out there doing a camping trip, you've got that stuff. You've got a stove. You've got a river full of water, by and large. You've got some food. And as long as you can recapture your craft, you're going to be all right. Now, if the your last view of the raft is upside down and going around the corner in a class 4 river, that's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah. What about communication? That's something that's changed through the years, and there's some hardcore guys like Dick Griffith who like to walk across the Arctic, and they don't want any communication because they don't want to be rescued if they get in trouble because they're so tough. My thing when I'm taking my kids or guests out, I really want to have whatever communication I can get because I'd like to be able to make sure everybody's as safe as possible, and I'm not there to prove anything. How do you guys take that communication issue?
I'd have to say I'm more in the Dick Griffin category. I don't take GPS. I don't take sat phone. You know, I'm not interested in doing it that way. It's part of the challenge. But I'm also very experienced, and I take all the other precautions. I try not to let people bring electronic devices at all on these trips because that's not what they're about for me.
You know? Uh-huh.
On the other hand, depending on the nature of the trip, I understand, especially in a commercial setting, you want the guides to have a sat phone. You want them to have, you know, backup plans and all that kind of stuff, even to the extent of having, your air charter operator planning to fly the river the day after you don't make your pickup, that kind of thing.
But what about if you were to take a sat phone and have it in some kind of otter box and you decide, well, we're never going to open it, and it's just like your medical kit, and then, you know, 3 days out, somebody has a serious injury, you know, a head injury or something. Wouldn't you like to have that phone to get a helicopter to come get them?
Let me say, if you've got it, use it. But no, do I want that phone? No. It's just a risk I'm willing to take, but I'm also ultra cautious in other ways. I've paddled whitewater rivers in a single boat trip, which is not recommended, in the Brooks Range with my 16-year-old son, and I don't take any of that stuff. But I want him to experience life out on the edge. At least that's part of what Alaska is about.
Okay. Les?
No, yeah. Les from New York over here has a little bit different view. Now, I wouldn't want to cross Fifth Avenue by myself, but Les could probably manage that.
Well, I'm from Alaska, so I can back Les up.
Okay.
So, I mean, I know Venable wouldn't take those things. Venable is in the top 1% when it comes to people with whitewater skills, wilderness skills. He's the guy, if I go out with Venable, I've got no fear. I know that if I'm going to die, he's going to die too, probably. So, Venable is, he's got that top 1% of skills in the wilderness. You can rent a sat phone. There are devices you can bring out that hook up to your iPhone or your Android to make that a sat phone. At least you can text people. There are a few options. They are smart things to bring. If you really don't, you have to measure your skill set and whether you can afford it. But yeah, bring it if you can. Often we have brought stuff like that. I did a float on the Conga Cut a few years ago, and one of my friends brought something that turned his iPhone into a sat phone device, at least for texting, as I recall.
Do you find that the temptation of people get out and start trying to do Pokemon Go in the wilderness or something? And I mean, that's an exaggeration, but to push back against people using the electronics when they don't need it?
Well, I think Venable and I would throw somebody out of camp. Well, I don't think I'd be able to, but no, the best way you'd ever bring is board games or cards, you know?
And, yeah.
And frankly, on a raft trip, you know, the fun of it, you know, we've talked about the danger of it. And really, if you're outside of Anchorage, you're not in a place where there's a course, go with somebody who knows what they're doing before you do it.
Right.
Please don't do it without knowing what you're doing.
Yep.
There's a sentence in one of the rafting books I'll read later on that essentially says that. But the beautiful thing about these trips, you know, let's say you don't feel like carrying an 80-pound backpack. You can bring gourmet meals on a raft trip, you know, whether it's a one-day trip or a five-day trip, whether it's a fly-in or a road system trip. You know, if you refrigerate and freeze your stuff right, you can bring, maybe yeah, if you want to have a sip or two, you can bring something to drink. Not while you're rafting. And Venable and I are probably the same on this. We don't drink when we raft. And I don't think Venable does. And I think that's what you're taught on the courses also. If it's a serious river, you don't drink during the day.
Yeah, it all goes back again to preparation and knowing what you're getting into. If I was going to do something like, one of these Turnback Canyon or the Devil's Canyon of the Sioux or something like that, you'd want a higher level of backup, and a sat phone might be appropriate.
Yep.
But you use some of these sources, the guidebooks, you talk to your air charter operator, you talk to people who've been on these rivers, you go to these Knit Canoers and Kayakers meetings and you talk to people who've done them. You get some idea of what you're getting into, and then you can know whether you need to whether your skill set matches the river, overpowers the river, or is overpowered by the river, and therefore you want to take these extra measures. I don't say I'd never take anything, but – I'll say I mostly never take anything.
I hear you.
I know what I'm doing and I know where I'm going before I go.
He actually takes a bunch of safety stuff that isn't a sat phone. Very few people have a pulley system. Venable knows how to pulley a raft off a rock. You can't just pull it sometimes.
Do it.
So, he's underselling the safety stuff that he brings.
And of course, I have my waterproof copy of War and Peace in case I get stuck on an island somewhere for a week waiting for
there
a
you
rescue.
Go. Well, and we're going to talk more about this in the second half, and also we're going to talk more about some of the fun stuff. We're not trying to scare people off away from the water, but and get some suggestions of great places to go if you're just getting started. You know, one of the things that I find interesting in doing this show is I get folks in of all different generations. I'm not like a super outdoors person, so I'm just learning as I do the show, and we've got three guys with a few gray hairs today who are talking about keep the electronics away, and I've also talk to folks in their 20s who are also amazing outdoors people who love the electronics and sort of integrate that into their whole thing. So could be that times are changing. Anyway, stay with us for the second half. My guests are Les Guerra in Venable, Vermont. We're talking about floating Alaska's rivers, and we'll be back with more as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We are talking today about river safety and also just about river floating and the pleasure of floating Alaska's river, something we've done many times before, but I don't think there's ever a reason to stop. And I've got two guests who are both very experienced on this topic and have spent, most of a lifetime floating Alaska's river. Venable, Vermont, who is, retired from the law and is now floated many of Alaska's rivers and a whitewater enthusiast, and Les Guerra, who is also very interested in floating and has done a lot of floating and done a lot of fishing. He's a member of the State House of Representatives, but is unopposed in this year's election. So we spent the first half of the show, gentlemen, kind of scaring people off. And now I would like to make people want to do this activity, which is so great and such an integral part of seeing Alaska. And I thought maybe we could start. I want to get to some beginner opportunities or opportunities for folks who are just developing their skills. But let's talk about some dream trips first. Like, what are some of the trips that have been most memorable and most challenging for you guys, and that you would, that are really sort of in your hall of fame? I don't know who wants to go first. Les, you're kind of.
I'll mention one because I think we agree, and I also wanted to mention something else about it. We've talked about the Conga Cut here. It's probably my number one favorite. It's remote. It's exotic. You start up in the Brooks Range. It's in the Brooks Range, by the way. It's in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's up in that far northeast corner of Alaska, where because of Canadian restrictions on small planes, there's not a lot of air traffic of small planes going back and forth across the border. So it's stuck up there in a corner, and it's quiet. It's got all the wildlife. You can do a number of hikes, and I've done at least a half a dozen trips up there, and every one of them has a hike of about a week's duration, and then you float down to the ocean. And you go across the coastal plain. There's all kind of animals out there. It's just fabulous. It's got some white water. It's got this canyon that is, I think, more intimidating to Les than it is to me, as it should be. But it has its difficulties, no question about that. It also comes up and down quickly, the river does, and that's one of the things you need to be aware of. But by and large, it's a wide open river, and you can avoid most of the stuff.
How do you get there?
First, I'd say you drive to Fairbanks if you're down here in South Central, and then you either fly commercially to Fort Yukon and charter from there, or you fly commercially to Arctic Village and have your charter operator float from there. You could actually come from Dead Horse. I've been picked up from Dead Horse on a number of those rivers that are in the Arctic Refuge. So that's one of the things that depends on your pocketbook and your timing. You know, you call around and find right. out.
There's plenty of guide services taking people up there.
I don't know that I'd say plenty, but there are. They're available. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Congakut, I'd say, is right up there, number one for me.
And the beauty of it, the remoteness.
It's a clear water river, so it's got some fishing. The wildlife can be just unbelievable. When you get up there and you've timed it right, either by intention or by luck, to be on the ground with the porcupine caribou herd migrating through. And there's always wolves and bears around the edges. You see some moose. It's fabulous. And the weather's generally very good. People don't know that, but it's generally very... Oh, I didn't mean to say that. We're on the air, right? it's generally nice up there in late June and July.
Uh-huh. Les, do you have a Hall of Fame to nominate?
Oh, you know, the Congakut is a great river. I mean, there are a number of them up there. The Colville, the Hula Hula, I haven't done. I've done the Marsh Fork on the Colville. And the thing about those floats up on the sort of north slope is, you've got the river and you've got that part of it, but if you hike, and my wife Kelly doesn't like fishing that much, but she loves hiking, it becomes a trip that you both like, right? So, and on some of those rivers, you know, a lot of tundra is sort of hard to hike in, but those rivers they're like carpeted mountains. You know, it's hard footing.
Those foothills of the Brooks Range on the north side are just fabulous.
Yeah, unlike the Bob Marshall stories with the tussocks and all that stuff.
Want to stay out of the
Brooks Range and the south side.
Yeah, it's different than the Noatak. The Noatak is much more tussocky, and the Noatak used to be the It River, the one that everybody did because it was the first one people talked about,
uh-huh.
and that's beautiful. But it's got more marsh, whereas the Colville, the Congakut, a lot of those rivers in the Arctic Refuge. Up in Anwar, there are a lot of places where you pull out, you're above brush line, you don't have to worry about walking through brush, and you walk up, you know, flower-covered, tundra-carpeted mountains. Which is beautiful. It takes me away from fishing, but, you know.
They'll be careful.
We've got to care about what Kelly wants to do, too. It's beautiful. But there are places that you can go to that don't cost anything. These are places where you need a fold-up raft or fold-up canoe that you can get into an airplane.
What's the fishing like in those Arctic rivers? Because I've been told that they're not super productive because of the environment in the short season.
Well, I know one of the area biologists who's retired, but he says, you know, you hit a grayling on one of those Arctic rivers, and if it's 14 inches, it might be 25 years old.
Yeah.
They grow slowly. There's not a lot of food in those rivers. In some of them, there are sea-run dollies, and there are resident dollies that are smaller and sea-run dollies, and the timing is fantastically unpredictable. The Congakut, the best understanding I have, is sometimes those dollies go out and feed in the ocean and then come back in July. Sometimes they come back in June. There are years where they don't go out at all if they... And
there are years where they don't seem to come in at all.
And there are years where they don't come in. So two of the three trips I've done on the Congakut, the dolly fishing, the sea-run dollies were there. They were fun to fish for. The one year, there were none other than the small, skinnier resident ones and their grayling.
In the late 80s and the early 90s, the dollies were there, and we just hit them phenomenal. You know, 8 and 10 and 12-pound fish. There'd be two or four in every hole. The grayling fishing, Les likes grayling. I'm not particularly interested in grayling, and it's hard to appreciate an 8-inch grayling as 25 years old versus an 8-inch grayling as 6 years old, you know. But don't make any mistake.
It's down to 8 inches already? I said 12.
Well, whatever. The point is these are not rainbow. They're not, by and large, the kind of dolly fishing or rainbow fishing.
Some people are crazy about them, though.
Yeah, some people are.
Some of my interior friends are obsessed with them.
But it, you're not catching a lot of fish, is what I want to say.
So
it's
I want
not
to ask
like
this
Southeast.
Of you, Les, as a fisherman, when you're floating a new river that you've never floated before, is that part of the challenge for you, is like figuring out this? Because every river is a little different in terms of fishing, right?
Yeah, well, I'll obviously figure out the fishing if mm-hmm. I can. But, you know, sometimes you're surprised. You're too early for the run. You're too late for the run. Or what will happen on a good portion of your float trips, the river will come up and flood out and turn brown, and your fishing trip turns to nothing, which is the kind of trip Venable usually takes me on. But and then I got to listen to he and another Southerner talk about pork belly and all the things you can do with pork belly. That's a trip with Venable. I had 4 days of that once. But... So the fishing can be unpredictable. There are places where it's very predictable, where you know that trout feed on salmon eggs, you know, so you know mm-hmm. the timing of the salmon run, and then you know when the trout are going to be there because they're going to be there when the salmon are spawning. Those are easier to predict. But the whitewater part, there are books, you know, that go through most of the, not most of the rivers, but a good number of the popular rivers in the state.
In terms of the predictability of what you're going to run into.
Yeah, you want to.
Maybe not the fishing.
Yeah, you want to know, is the class two water, which is not really serious.
Let's explain the class system, the classifications and what that means for listeners.
Two is basically any moving water. Once the water starts moving, they call it class two, right?
One is moving water. Two begins to have some difficulties, but they're easy. They're obvious and easy to avoid.
All right. What he said.
What is like your slow-moving brown river that you can be in an inner tube?
The Chena, right?
Yeah, a one. Yeah, 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 that's a one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Three has some white water, and that, frankly, if you have no experience, you shouldn't do. But if I taught somebody yesterday the class three rapid on the Kenai, not hard if you have the experience. You just need to have gone with somebody who's taught you what to do. And then higher three, it's a lot of rock dodging where you get stuck on a rock, you get pinned on a rock. You know, three is sort of it's a weird classification. Three goes from a very short rapid like on the Kenai to like miles of class three rapids, which can get taxing, and you dodge a lot of rocks, you can get stuck. And class four is much more significant.
Bigger holes, bigger waves, harder to avoid the obstacles.
Uh-huh.
Maybe a lot of rock dodging.
Yeah, maybe a lot. Yeah.
Well, how do you look at a river and say, well, this, I mean, somebody's got to classify it. I would think there'd be a lot of judgment.
There's a lot of judgment, and one of the things I wanted to mention is that that I frequently do is because Alaska's got cold water, remote water, and opportunities for rescue are remote. If you don't know a river very well, even if you've got, say, class three skills, you might want to rate it as a four and take all your actions appropriate to that. Because if something happens, even if it's, let's say you look at a rapid and you got 90% confidence in running it, you're going to make it 9 out of 10 times. The one time you don't, what are the consequences if you don't? Well, they're going to be greater in, say, on the Conga Cut or somewhere remote than they are on a roadside river. So you might want to rate the river as a four rather than a three to give yourself that extra room and caution, or you might want to walk what would otherwise be a class three rapid that you would run if you're on a day trip, you know, right by the highway,
uh-huh.
which in the, you know, in the States outside, a lot of the whitewater is right by the highway.
Right. It seems like to me like the number really doesn't tell you everything you need to know.
Oh, it definitely does not. It definitely does not. And then, as Les has mentioned a couple of times, the water can go up and down. The rapids, the degree of difficulty will change. So you've got to make that on the ground decision when you're there, not based on what your friend did last year, not based on what's in the book, and not based on what your air charter operator tells you.
Yeah. Did you want to say something, Les, about the book?
Oh, yeah. And then the other thing we haven't talked very much is sweepers. So even if there's no whitewater, if there's a tree hanging out into the river, that's what we call a sweeper. You see the part above the river, but what you have to realize is there are branches below the river. You fall out of your boat or you get stuck on a sweeper in your boat, and you could get caught in that whole tangle of branches that you don't see below the river. You know, the thing I think about is a lot of people who do wilderness racing who are really strong and really fast. Some of them think since they're strong and fast, they can do the pack rafting part of the race or of the trip they're going to take. And strength does not make you a moving water person. You know, so I would really recommend for people in pack rafts who are strong to also take a course or get some training. I know people who are, you know, top five finishers in running races who have done wilderness races that have a pack rafting component and have gotten in trouble. And
there's classes you can take on that too. There's a guy giving those classes, and we'll have those links to some of the opportunities to get that training on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show and you'll find the links as well as information about our guests.
Let me give an example.
Let me just reintroduce Venable, Vermont, who you're about to hear from, and Les Guerra, to our two guests. Venable?
I wanted to give an example of a river that a lot of your listeners might be aware of the kind of thing that Les is talking about, and that's Upper Eagle River between the Canoe Put-In and the Campground Rapid. doesn't go particularly fast. It's got some limited whitewater upriver from the campground rapid, which is a very serious rapid. But it's by and large just moving water, but it has a lot of sweepers and a lot of tight bends, and you've got to know how to either back away or aggressively get around those things, because it's a dangerous river, and yet a lot of people get on it because there's an easy, paved, nice parking lot, and it says canoe put in and this and that.
Yeah.
But you can get in trouble on that kind of water.
Well, let's talk for a minute about some of the introductory or the easier floats that people can do. We've scared them enough at this point, because there are. If you're comfortable with lake canoeing and you know how to do that safely, and you know that you're going to take your PFD and you're going to wear it all the time, and you're going to have your warm clothing, and you're going to have all the stuff prepared. Hopefully, you've taken a class. Then the next stage is one of these very slow moving rivers that doesn't have any rapids. And we were talking during the break, the Swanson River would fall in this category down outside of Sterling, where you can float from the road that goes from Sterling down to the Captain Cook Recreation Area near Nikiski. And that's kind of a good family float. Any thoughts on those, like sort of the introductory floats, or maybe you've got taken the class and you're ready to go up to sort of the next step up?
Well, another easy one is Little Willow, which doesn't have any white water, and the turns aren't particularly tight or pushy, to be distinguished from Willow, which is a different can of worms because it's a lot pushier and has a lot of sweepers and that kind of thing.
And where's Little Willow?
5 miles north of Willow, just up the Parks Highway. Mm-hmm. Willow's at mile 70 or so. There's a highway bridge and a put-ins right there.
There can be some sweepers there, though.
Yeah, right? Oh, yeah, there can be. Yeah, yeah. I don't mean there's no...
There's never going to be zero hazard.
There's never
right?
There's never zero hazard, yeah.
If you're up in Fairbanks, it's Chena, the Chattanooga.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking of some more remote ones. Again, it depends on what you're doing, but something like the Mulchatna, you know, is an easy river. If you're in a raft, it's only got a few things of white water. If you're going out there for a caribou hunt, for example, that's an easy one. And, you know, there's 250 miles of it anyway that you can do. But it's, you know, that's one of the difficulties in Alaska is not a lot of this stuff is right there on the road system. You may have a put-in or a takeout, but you've got to fly or, you know, mountain bike or whatever to
it's
get
kind of
to the
good,
other.
Kind of the good part, too, though.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It is. Yeah, absolutely.
Wes?
And there are places to go get a lot of solitude. There, unfortunately, aren't a lot of, like, really, really easy rivers right on the road system.
Yeah.
There are somewhat easy rivers. Even the Kenai, you know, just with a little bit of training, you do need the training. The upper river has one rock they call Preacher's Rock. The legend is that a preacher hit the rock and flipped, and we don't know if that's true. And then the river through the canyon has that class 3 rapid. I mean, just some training. That's one of the more popular ones. And you know, obviously the lower Chena up in Fairbanks. Venable has a river that he's sent people to that's a fly-in if they want a remote fly-in. You know, if you decide you're going to spend your money not on a snow machine, but on a fly-in. And some of them aren't terribly expensive if you drive far enough. It's the Wild River. Is that the?
Oh well, yeah. That's not a bad one. Although, you know, it can be a little pushy. They get some rain. It's in the Central Brooks Range, and it comes down from Wild Lake into Bettles. And you know that's another thing is that middle fork of the Koyukuk. You can get off at there's a couple of road stops and gas stations there on the south side of the Brooks Range. You can put in at either one and float down to Bettles, and that's not particularly difficult.
Uh-huh.
But again, sweepers, you know, it's remote when you're in there, but then you got to fly out of Bettles, you know.
And there's some village-to-village floats in northwest Alaska, right? And I'm thinking, is it the Noatak where you can do that?
I know people have done the Noatak. I've only done the Noatak with the mayor of Noatak. In a motorboat to fish for sheefish.
Something like the Colville or the Noatak, those are long rivers. I mean, you can do a shorter one, but you're not getting as much bang for your buck.
Yeah.
By the time you pay for a charter to put you in and pick you up, you might as well stay and do 3 weeks' worth, you know? Same would be true on several others.
I said the Noatak. I didn't mean the Noatak, and now I'm drawing a blank. The Noatak is actually, that's a wilderness river, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about that one with the sheepfish or in Kanu that's up north of Kivalina, north of Kotz?
God, it's my first senior moment, man. But no, there are rivers you can go village to village for sure. And then some people do the Yukon, right? The Yukon is...
Yeah, we just did a show on that about floating the Yukon. And we did. We had somebody who did the canoe race that they have from Whitehorse to Dawson. And then we talked to an APU professor who takes his students out every fall to go from Eagle to Circle. So
that's more of a cultural and other kinds of things. You know, there's not a lot of river excitement per se in a big, wide glacial river. I try to stay away from them because they just don't do much for
me. You find it boring?
Yeah, pretty boring. And yeah, there's just not a lot there. You're not going to see a lot of wildlife, and you're going to encounter motorboats and stuff like that. If you like to sit in the raft and talk to your professor all day and get brownie points, hey, that's not bad, you know? But there's plenty of time for conversation, and that's one of the nice things about river trips. Either we're on the, in the raft during the day or the campfire at night.
So it's a point counterpoint here on Outdoor Explorer. now you're hearing the downside of the Yukon River. So let's talk a little bit about preparation and choosing where you're going to go. You guys brought a bunch of books in, and I know people over the years have cataloged their experiences on Alaskan rivers and written it down. Les, do you have some recommendations in that line?
On rivers?
On books to learn about?
You know, there are a few. There's the Alaska River Guide by Karen Jetmar, and that's got a number of rivers in it. Tells you what the danger is, what the water is like. The first one is the Alaska Paddling Guide, and it's still good. It's a lot of the rivers have changed a little bit, but that's a good book. There's Fast and Cold.
I wonder if these books are still in print.
I believe they are, yeah.
Karen Jetmar's book has got a second edition to it, and so does Dapkus and Mosby, the Alaska Paddling Guide. Les is showing his age and his tenderfootness or his chichaco-ness or whatever it is. The actual first guide up here was Sepp Weber, and that's a really hard book to find, and it doesn't have a lot of information in terms of current, what we look for, you know, in terms of river classifications and stuff like that, or for that matter, even put-ins and takeouts, which is really what you want to know is where you can go.
Yeah, the books will tell you where you can put in, where you can take out, and then what sections of the rivers. If those are rivers that have sections, which ones have the whitewater? The Lower Gulkana, for example, the lower part of it is pretty flat. The upper part of it has a Class 4 rapid and a lot of Class 3 water for a few miles. So if you had no experience, well, I wouldn't say no experience. If you had training, but you weren't a whitewater person, there's the Lower Gulkana, which I believe starts at Sourdough. Is that the lower part?
Yeah. You put in at Sourdough.
Yeah. And
the upper part is the run from
the upper part
the
is
lake,
from the
lake,
lake the lake down to Sourdough.
Yeah.
And that does have rapids. So that's a river with sections that you could drive to. That's, you know, basically you need your watercraft, but
and there is a boardwalk to walk around that one Class 4 rapid, and a lot of people do. Right. Even if they take rafts, they portage them around.
Yeah, you don't have to be manly about it, you know, or super womanly about it, right? You can line your, they call it lining your boat through the rapids. As long as you have a good strong rope and a couple people, a lot of rapids, not all, but a lot of rapids you can walk your way through.
Yep. So what do you guys do to plan a trip? What's the process of setting up a trip and deciding what you're going to do? And do you know so much that you don't need a plan anymore?
No, that's a dangerous assumption to make, and I'd caution people against that. I think the first, for me, is the goal. What do I want to do? You know, am I bringing some family from outside? Is this going to be a hardcore fishing trip like I've done with Les and some of our other friends? Is this going to be a hunting trip? We want to try to get a caribou, and if so, how long do we want to be out there? How long do we want to, you know, carry meat and hang it up every night, this and that? So decide what you want first, and then decide how much time you've got, and then a realistic assessment of your capacity. And then, you know, you're also looking at, well, where have I been before? Where would I like to go? You weigh all that stuff in there. But I'd say choose your goal first, because that's going to determine who you take with you, the kind of gear.
Right. You probably got all that information before, and then you're choosing a destination.
Yeah.
Les?
Yeah.
And, you know, and frankly, I mean, you know, what you're going to do to deal or could be a barren camp, could be a few, you know, could be a berry river.
A berry river is a river that not that you eat the berries from, but that you have lots of bears on it. Right, Les?
Yeah, and you're going to see those more often during spawning season on a salmon river, but that could be anywhere. And so obviously you got to figure out what you're going to do about that. You know, so far we've never had a bear problem in, I don't know, 30 floats, 40 floats of, you know.
Do you guys plan out every day of food, or do you, I mean, some people like have a menu where they know exactly what we're going to eat every minute. Others just say, okay, we're going to bring some of this and some of this and some of this, and we'll figure it out each day.
I plan pretty carefully. So I like doing the cooking, so I don't have to do the dishes. That's pretty much the deal. And if you're on a multi-day float, you could freeze. Let's say you could freeze, if you're going to bring steaks, you could freeze your steak, and that will act as ice for a couple of days.
Yeah.
You could freeze egg beater cartons, and that'll act as ice for a couple of days. Then you could have you could have burritos in the morning. And that's the nice thing about rafting, and to some extent canoeing, is you can bring more stuff for food, more fresh food, than you can backpacking. You got to figure out what you're going to do to make sure your camp doesn't smell, and you're not going to keep your food in camp especially if you're remote and away from help. But I find the food fun in planning that stuff out and finding a way to pack enough stuff that I can freeze that it'll act as ice, because especially if you're going to fly in somewhere, you can't really afford the weight of the ice.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And then you eat freeze-dried meals the last 2 or 3 days of a week or 10-day trip. And then I would say always put in at least 1 day's worth of extra food, although we seem to have more than that at the end a lot of times. But you just can't ever count on getting picked up on the day your pickup is planned.
Right. So we're near the end here, and I want to make sure that we hit the highlights again for safety, and because that was our main topic today. Just take home, do take home on safety, Les?
Yeah, there's a line in the Alaska River Guide. It's one of the books that talk about whitewater rivers and non-whitewater rivers in the state. And it says, do your homework, read up on the river, and talk to as many knowledgeable people as you can. Don't go until you have the paddling ability for the river you want to visit. And that's the hardest thing, is talking people who have a lot of confidence into getting the training first. And, I had that problem with a friend of mine recently, and we agreed that we would do the rapids on the Kenai together. I didn't really want him doing the rapids on his own if without somebody with him. So, yeah, make sure you have the paddling skills.
Yeah. Edible?
I want to go back to what I started with and hit that again pretty hard, is wear your dadgum life jacket. That's like putting on your seatbelt in your car. You know, we all know how many stories we read about, you know, these car rollovers, and the one who was seatbelted in lives and the other one's thrown out dies. Well, you read the same thing about these drowning accidents. Didn't have on a life jacket. And so, one, you've got to wear your life jacket if you get in a boat on the water. I don't care what circumstances are. And number two, you got to have a mindset that you're going to self-rescue if something happens, because the initial drowning, the inhalation of that water, can happen in the first few seconds, or the getting stuffed under a rock or stuffed under a sweeper can happen. And the other people are 50 feet away in moving water. They're not going to get to you. You're dead within 45 seconds. So
yeah.
Life jacket and a mindset to self-rescue.
The right life jacket. Moving fast water requires a bigger, thicker life jacket than canoe life jackets. People need to know that.
Well, hopefully listeners are still excited, but also are going to be cautious and thoughtful about their river trips. Thanks very, very much to you, Les Guerra. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Les is up for election, but nobody's running against him, so kind of don't have to worry about giving him too much airplay today. And Venable, Vermont, thanks for coming in. I really enjoyed meeting you.
Happy to be here, and I'm not running for anything, and I never will.
All right, good. me neither, so we're all good on that. My name is Charles Wolforth. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer works on lining up guests is Hannah Duro. And please join us again next week. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.